Lecture 10, Novelists of the 1840s, Thackeray.
In the next two lectures, we'll turn our attention to the 1840s, one of the most important decades in the history of the English novel. The literary culture of this decade is interesting for a number of reasons, as Kathleen Tillotson and other scholars have explained. First, by the time we get to the 1840s, the novel form is about 100 years old. You'll remember that Richardson and Fielding published their first works in the 1740s. By the time we get to the 1840s, earlier fears about the ill effects of novel reading had largely faded. Particular novels might still be viewed as dangerous, but the novel form was now familiar enough to be unthreatening. And through this decade, there was as yet no great divide between popular and sophisticated tastes, at least as far as the novel was concerned. Many of the most popular novels of this decade were also some of the best, and a few of them are still worth reading. Near the end of the decade, as Dickens was beginning to refine his own approach to the novel form, several new writers were coming on the scene. These writers included William Makepeace Thackeray, author of Vanity Fair, Charlotte Bronte, and Emily Bronte, authors of Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights. Thackeray and the Brontes offered attractive alternatives to Dickens and probably also goaded him into even greater achievements. Before we consider these developments, however, let's familiarize ourselves with some of the larger issues at stake in the 1840s. The 40s are a decade of political upheaval. The Reform Bill of 1832 has extended voting rights to some members of the middle class, and working-class men and women are now asking to be included in the political process as well. This is the period of the Chartist movement, organized around a people's charter, something like a modern petition, calling for universal suffrage and voting by secret ballot, among other things. The charter was rejected by Parliament three separate times. The first time it was submitted with 250,000 signatures, the second with around 3 million. The movement inspired massive demonstrations, at least one of which was put down by armed troops. These soldiers, firing on the demonstrators, killed 24 people and wounded another 40. The movement more or less fizzled out in 1848 when its leaders chose not to go through with a massive demonstration in London. Radical historians still wonder what might have happened if those folks hadn't lost their nerve. The 1840s are also a decade of economic upheaval. From the 1820s on through the 40s, railway lines are being extended across the nation, and by 1850, some 6,000 miles of track will have been laid, establishing the railway network still in use today. At the same time, a new phase of the Industrial Revolution is beginning, with the coal, iron, and steel industries becoming more and more important. The English economy is also experiencing an unprecedented volatility, suffering especially severe slumps in the early 40s. Finally, the 40s are a decade of widespread suffering. The Irish potato famine occurs between 1845 and 51, killing as many as a million people. A major cholera epidemic also breaks out in 1848, taking as many as 50,000 lives. Now, for Thackeray, the most important of these developments may be the economic ones. Before we see why, let's consider the events of his own life. Thackeray's dates are 1811 to 1863. He was born in Calcutta. Always surprises me to hear that. Where his father worked for the East India Company and later collected taxes. And there are references to Indian cooking, Indian civil servants, Indian slang, sort of peppered throughout Thackeray's writing. After his father's death, while he was still very young, Thackeray was sent to live and study, go to school in England. And on the way, while his ship was in port at St. Helena, he actually caught a glimpse of Napoleon in exile. He left Cambridge without taking his degree, largely because of the financial crisis brought on by gambling. So some things haven't changed. And he started his literary career as a journalist and editor. He enjoyed some success as a writer of humorous pieces. He had a great gift for parody, eventually producing much of his best early work for Punch. But his domestic life was marked by bitter disappointment. The cause was the complete mental breakdown of his wife, which occurred only 4 years into their marriage. Following the breakdown, Thackeray was forced to place his wife in an asylum where she lived for another 50 years. Thackeray never remarried and seems to have devoted himself to the care of his two daughters, one of whom became a novelist in her own right. His great breakthrough came with Vanity Fair, a novel published in monthly installments on the model of Dickens and set in the period of the Napoleonic Wars. The Battle of Waterloo, fought in 1815, provides the backdrop for several of the novel's most dramatic scenes. We'll examine those scenes a bit later. For now, let's just remember that it was Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo that led to his final exile on St. Helena. In choosing this historical setting, Thackeray places himself in the tradition of Sir Walter Scott. Yet unlike Scott, whose efforts at historical accuracy we've already noted, Thackeray sometimes seems to forget that he's writing a historical novel. Indeed, Thackeray is at least as interested in the 1840s as he is in the period of the Napoleonic Wars, giving special attention to the emergence of a new class of capitalist financiers. This new group is represented in the novel by the character of Amelia Sedley, the daughter of a wealthy London stockbroker. Thackeray's portrayal of Amelia and her family is probably one of the novel's anachronisms. The novel is set in the 18-teens, as I've noted, but it was the 40s that actually witnessed a boom in speculation as middle-class investors entered the market in large numbers for the first time. Amelia is contrasted with her schoolmate Becky Sharp, an orphan descended from two bohemian artists. Her father is a painter and her mother is an opera singer, not a diva, just a singer in the chorus. In sharp contrast to Amelia, Becky has no social advantages beyond her own intelligence and charm. Now, fortunately, those are considerable. At the beginning of the novel, these two young women are leaving school, they're finished with school, for Amelia's house in London. When they arrive, Amelia takes her friend on a tour, and we see just how well her father has been able to provide for his family. "You may be sure," the narrator tells us, "that she showed Rebecca over every room of the house and everything in every one of her drawers, and her books, and her piano, and her dresses, and all her necklaces, brooches, laces, and gimcracks. She insisted upon Rebecca accepting the white cornelian and the turquoise rings and a sweet sprigged muslin, which was too small for her now, though it would fit her friend to a nicety. And she determined in her heart to ask her mother's permission to present her white cashmere shawl to her friend. Could she not spare it? And had not her brother Joseph just brought her two from India?" Evidently, Mr. Sedley has done very well for himself and his family. Before moving on, we might note that in this passage, Amelia's generosity is set against her carelessness. She means to be nice, to share what she has, especially if it doesn't really fit her anymore, but she never considers the impact of her extravagance on her poor friend. How is Becky to look upon the books, the piano, the dresses, and the necklaces without feeling at least a touch of real resentment? With this passage, then, Thackeray sharpens his social commentary, reminding us that it's easy for the wealthy to take their privileges for granted. Now, as the novel moves forward, finances play a major role in the lives of both these characters. By chapter 17, not even a fourth of the way through the book, Amelia's father is ruined, forced to declare bankruptcy and auction off his possessions. Bankruptcy looms as a frightening possibility in many Victorian novels. It carried a great moral stigma throughout the period, but Thackeray's treatment of the issue seems distinctive. Throughout the chapter on the Sedley's bankruptcy, Thackeray skillfully manipulates the reader. And I want to take you through this passage and show you exactly how he does it. The narrator begins the chapter with some witty generalizations about auctions, never hinting at what has happened to Mr. Sedley. "There are very few London people," the narrator says. "There are very few London people, I fancy, who have not attended at these meetings, and all with a taste for moralizing must have thought, with a sensation and interest not a little startling and queer, of the day when their turn shall come too, and Mr. Hammerdown, a made-up name for an auctioneer, will sell by the orders of Diogenes' assignees, or will be instructed by the executors to offer public competition, the library, furniture, plate, wardrobe, and choice cellar wines of Epicurus, deceased." At this point, the alert reader, noting all of those references to death, might be wondering which of the major characters, if any, has passed away. After a few pages, through which the narrator invites all kinds of further speculation, we learn the truth. The auction is at the Sedley's house, as we've had reason to suspect, but the occasion is not the old man's death. Instead, it's something even worse. "The sale was at the old house in Russell Square," the narrator says, "where we passed some evenings together at the beginning of this story. Good old John Sedley was a ruined man. His name had been proclaimed as a defaulter on the stock exchange, and his bankruptcy and commercial extermination had followed." Mr. Sedley has not only been ruined, not only been forced to declare himself a bankrupt, he's been exterminated, like some sort of insect or vermin. As the passage goes on, we sense the complicated feelings that his collapse seems to inspire in his friends and former colleagues. "Mr. Osborne's butler," the narrator tells us, "came to buy some of the famous port wine to transfer to the cellars over the way. So it sounds like the butler has already gotten another job and is coming over to get a good deal on this wine for his new boss. As for one dozen well-manufactured silver spoons and forks at per ounce, and one dozen dessert ditto ditto, there were three young stockbrokers, Messrs. Dale, Spigot, and Dale, of Threadneedle Street indeed, who, having had dealings with the old man and kindnesses from him in days when he was kind to everybody with whom he dealt, sent this little spar out of the wreck with their love to good Mrs. Sedley." Now, finally, we see why the narrator thinks that an auction may be the only exhibition in all Vanity Fair which satire and sentiment can visit arm in arm together. While some take pleasure in Mr. Sedley's collapse, scooping up his famous port wine, others look upon the event with real sadness. The family's financial collapse has serious consequences. Indeed, it nearly prevents Amelia's marriage to George Osborne, her childhood sweetheart. Even after George declares his intentions to marry Amelia, his own father, another worthy, wealthy merchant and a sort of longtime rival to Mr. Sedley, his own father cuts him off without a cent. In the meantime, Becky has married Rawdon Crawley, son to Sir Pitt Crawley, and Thackeray is just a genius with these names, I think, in whose home she has been serving as a governess. These two don't have any money either, and eventually both George and Rawdon find themselves in the army. In a startling development, George dies at Waterloo, leaving the widowed Amelia to raise their son alone. The passage in which his death is revealed suggests the complexity of Thackeray's approach to its audience. It's even more interesting, even richer, than the passage about the auction, because it contrasts the army's triumph over Napoleon, which is still, in 1847, a matter of national pride, with George's destruction and Amelia's loss. "All our friends took their share and fought like men in the great field," the narrator says, "all day long, whilst the women were praying 10 miles away." And here I should just explain that both Amelia and Becky have come to Brussels, near Waterloo, with their husbands. The lines of the dauntless English infantry were receiving and repelling the furious charges of the French horsemen. Guns which were heard at Brussels were plowing up their ranks, and comrades falling, and the resolute survivors closing in. Towards evening, the attack of the French, repeated and resisted so bravely, slackened in its fury. They had other foes besides the British to engage, or were preparing for a final onset. Let's break there, because it's interesting to see how calmly and dispassionately the narrator reports all of this. He and his readers know the outcome of the battle. At this point, 30 years removed from the battle itself, they may actually enjoy this measure of restraint. The French attack came at last, the narrator adds. The columns of the Imperial Guard marched up the hill of Saint-Jean, at length and at once, to sweep the English from the height which they had maintained all day. In spite of all, unscared by the thunder of the artillery, which hurled death from the English line, the dark rolling column pressed on and up the hill. It, that is, the column of French troops, seemed almost to crest the eminence when it began to waver and falter. Then it stopped, still facing the shot. Then at last, the English troops rushed from the post from which no enemy had been able to dislodge them, and the guard turned and fled. Okay, so let's take a break again, and note that this is a triumph for the British nation. They've defeated the French. They've defeated the hated Napoleon. Yet as we discover in the next paragraph, it's a disaster for Thackeray's characters. No more firing was heard at Brussels, the narrator tells us. The pursuit rolled miles away. Darkness came down on the field and city, and Amelia was praying for George, who was lying on his face, dead, with a bullet through his heart. And that's the end of the chapter. As these events unfold, a number of fascinating questions emerge. Some of these questions are sociological. Are the newly rich financiers and businessmen asking for trouble? What happens to them and their families when their fortunes take a turn for the worse? Some of the questions are historical. How do we understand the role of warfare in human history? In thinking about an event like the Battle of Waterloo, how do we balance the gains to a nation with the losses suffered by individuals and their families? And finally, some of the questions are ethical. Is there, in a society organized around warfare and the acquisition of wealth, any reliable source of moral or personal value? Are all classes equally corrupt? And if so, does that corruption infect every single individual? Those questions are enormously important to Thackeray. Now, his place in literary history rests not only on his ability to raise those questions, for in Vanity Fair, he also creates one of the most innovative novels of the age. Vanity Fair is the first great example of the Victorian multi-plot novel, pointing the way toward many later works, including some of Dickens' greatest achievements. In earlier works, such as Tom Jones and Waverley, we chart the development of a single character or protagonist. In a multi-plot novel, by contrast, we are introduced to two or more clusters of characters. We see that these clusters are of more or less equal importance, which is why we should speak of multiple plots instead of a main plot and its subplots. Part of the pleasure of the multi-plot structure lies in the anticipation of an eventual union or merging of the various plots. We know that the characters must be related, we just can't tell how or why. The multi-plot structure was especially popular in the middle of the 19th century. Dickens had begun to experiment with it as early as Oliver Twist, and its prominence in the period reflects a mid-Victorian desire for social coherence and wholeness. And here I just might note that the multi-plot novel is a thing of the mid-Victorian period. It emerges in the 40s, as I've been trying to explain, and it kind of fades away in the 70s. Many people would argue that the last great example in the period of a multi-plot novel is Trollope's The Way We Live Now, which appears in 1875. I do think, though, that this form pops up again from time to time. I think that Ulysses, with Stephen Dedalus over here and Leopold Bloom over there, could be described as a multi-plot novel. And I think that there are actually a lot of movies that have this kind of multi-plot structure. And oddly enough, a number of these films seem to be set in Los Angeles. So Magnolia is like that, Shortcuts is like that, Crash is kind of like that. But in any case, we need to get back to Thackeray. And in dealing with a specific example of Vanity Fair, we need to refer to the Amelia plot and the Becky plot. That's the terminology we should use. Noting that the two plots are one and don't really diverge until the middle of the book after the scene at Waterloo. In most of the next few monthly parts, though he makes a point of updating both plots, Thackeray devotes most of his attention to Becky and Rawdon. He shows how Becky rises in society and how she destroys her marriage in the process. Eventually, Rawdon finds that he can no longer endure her infidelities. She seems to have been having an affair with Lord Steyne, and separates from her, moving to Coventry Island, where he serves as governor. Through this section of the novel, there are a total of 23 chapters, 17 devoted to the Becky plot, and only 6 focused on the Amelia plot. The balance shifts after that, as Thackeray gives us 6 consecutive chapters on Amelia, showing us how she copes with widowhood and financial hardship. In these chapters, he also shows us how she reconnects with Colonel William Dobbin, an old friend who has adored her from afar for years. Eventually, the Becky and Amelia plots converge again, and near the very end of the book, it is Becky who encourages Amelia to set aside her obsession with her dead husband and make a new life for herself with Dobbin. After Becky's husband dies of a fever on Coventry Island, she attaches herself to Amelia's brother, the one who brought back the cashmere shawls from India, and collects half of a very large insurance settlement after his very mysterious death. There is some suggestion that Becky is responsible for that death. The solicitor of the insurance company says that it's the blackest case that had ever come before him, but no conclusive proof. Indeed, readers and critics of the novel continue to debate the question of whether or not Becky killed Jos Sedley, and I think that that's just exactly how Thackeray wanted it. In thinking about Thackeray's contributions to the development of the novel form, we might also note that Vanity Fair is intended mostly for an audience of adults. Earlier novels had often been designed for all ages, avoiding subjects that might embarrass or confuse younger readers. And here we should note that the circulating libraries had often insisted on such an approach, refusing to stock any work that might be criticized as indecent. So they really had a kind of stranglehold over the publishing industry. If you couldn't get your book into a circulating library, you couldn't make any money. Vanity Fair, though never improper, deals more directly with matters of sex and sexual betrayal than works such as Nicholas Nickleby or Martin Chuzzlewit. The novel also refuses to idealize marriage and motherhood, suggesting in its portrayal of Amelia that a doting mother may do her children more harm than good. Along the way, Thackeray's novel rejects a number of other dominant assumptions about novelistic characterization and plotting. The book identifies itself as a novel without a hero, and that phrase is enormously important. That's the subtitle of the book. A novel without a hero. And Vanity Fair probably does without a villain as well. In Thackeray's world, everyone can be the object of ridicule or the focus of sympathy, including the narrator and the reader. Indeed, Thackeray refuses to let us feel superior to his imperfect characters, constantly reminding us of our own mistakes and flaws. To understand Thackeray's complex attitude, we might first recall the source of his title of Vanity Fair, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, in which the hero, Christian, enters the town of Vanity and makes his way through a fair at which all manner of earthly delights are on sale. Thackeray shares with Bunyan, and for that matter with the preacher in Ecclesiastes, a keen understanding of the ultimate emptiness of most human aspirations. We want money, we want status, we want fame, and most of it turns out to be worthless in the end. "Oh, brother wearers of motley," the narrator says at one point, apparently exhausted by the reader's continuing demand for comedy and diversion. "Oh, brother wearers of motley, are there not moments when one grows sick of grinning and tumbling and the jingling of cap and bells? This, dear friends and companions, is my amiable object, to walk with you through the fair, to examine the shops and the shows there and the gaiety, and be perfectly miserable in private." This passage is keenly ironic. He's just made his misery public, hasn't he? But it's still possible to smile at this sort of writing. In later passages, a smile is clearly not the most appropriate response. Here's an example. "You," the narrator says, "you, who see your betters meekly suffering under the slights of fortune, gentle and unpitied, poor and rather despised for their poverty, do you ever step down from your prosperity and wash the feet of these poor, wearied beggars? The very thought of them is odious and low."
"There must be classes, there must be rich and poor," Dives says, smacking his claret.
It is well if he even sends the broken meat out to Lazarus sitting under the window. Very true. But think how mysterious and often unaccountable it is, that lottery of life which gives to this man the purple and fine linen and sends to the other rags for garments and dogs for comforters. And as we're considering this passage, we might just remember that the 40s are known to modern historians as the Hungry 40s. And we might remember, too, the details about the potato famine and the cholera epidemic and the sort of wide fluctuations in the British economy through this decade. Okay, at the same time that Thackeray's narrator is challenging his readers to live up to their Christian values, he clearly delights in the things of this world. He's a very paradoxical, very complicated figure, this narrator. And he delights in the world's absurdity too, as we see in a striking passage from chapter 51, a passage offered as a kind of comment on Becky's social climbing. "It is all vanity, to be sure," the narrator says, "but who will not own to liking a little of it? I should like to know what well-constituted mind, merely because it is transitory, dislikes roast beef. That is a vanity, but may every man who reads this have a wholesome portion of it through life, I beg. I, though my readers were 500,000, sit down, gentlemen, and fall to with a good hearty appetite. The fat, the lean, the gravy, the horseradish, as you like it, don't spare it. Another glass of wine, Jones, my boy, a little bit of the Sunday side. Yes, let's eat our fill of the vain thing and be thankful therefor. And let us make the best of Becky's aristocratic pleasures likewise, for these two, like all other mortal delights, were but transitory." Thackeray's book probably makes its most striking departure from novelistic conventions by refusing to provide us with a conventional comedic ending. And this point could not be more important. All of the works that we've looked at so far, with the possible exception of Tristram Shandy, have ended in marriage, have ended with a kind of restabilized society. Now, as I've noted, Vanity Fair does indeed end with a long-awaited marriage between Amelia and Dobbin. Yet unlike Pamela or Tom Jones, Waverley or Pride and Prejudice, Vanity Fair does not present this marriage as a reward for the couple's virtues or the basis for a renewed social order. In the novel's closing paragraphs, we see a final meeting between Amelia and Becky. Amelia and Dobbin and their children, her son by her first husband, her daughter with Dobbin. They're visiting a fair, shades of Bunyan once again, where Becky is working at a booth raising money for charity. Emmy, that's a kind of pet name for Amelia, the narrator uses it every once in a while, her children, and the colonel, so he's got a promotion, coming to London sometime back, found themselves suddenly before Becky at one of these fairs. She cast down her eyes demurely and smiled as they started away from her, Emmy scurrying off on the arm of George, now grown a dashing young gentleman, that's her son, and the colonel seizing up his little Janie, of whom he is fonder than of anything in the world. "Fonder than he is of me," Emmy thinks with a sigh. But he never said a word to Amelia that was not kind and gentle, or thought of a want of hers that he did not try to gratify. Ah, vanitas vanitatum. Which of us is happy in this world? Which of us has his desire, or having it, is satisfied? Come, children, let us shut up the box and the puppets, for our play is played out. At the end, then, we sense that Amelia's marriage to Dobbin, though perfectly happy, is not blissful. He's unfailingly good to her, but his earlier devotion has faded. As for Becky herself, whether or not she's a murderess, she certainly falls far short of the standards set by earlier novelistic heroines. She has betrayed her husband, neglected her son, lied and taken advantage of other people, and she's clearly paid a price for that, as her isolation is contrasted with Amelia's immersion in family life. Nevertheless, Becky is not punished to the utmost. She does not die. She is not cast out of society. She is not forced to live in shame. Poetic justice may be upheld here, then, but not in the ways that experienced novel readers would have come to expect. In our next lecture, we'll continue our discussion of the novels of the 1840s, turning our attention to the works of Charlotte and Emily Bronte.